Okay, well, yeah, thanks. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to tell you about some of the stuff we're doing at Northwestern that's related to the sensitivity frontier, where we're using a variety of AMO-based sensors. So I wanted to just, at the beginning, just advertise our lab. Just recently moved, as of only 3 months ago, from University of Nevada in Reno down to Northwestern, where we have the newly established Center for Fundamental Physics, where the idea is to kind of gather a collection of people doing kind of tabletop experiments looking for high energy physics kind of effects. And so also at the center, in addition to our group, are the groups of Jerry Gabriels, where his activities include measuring the magnetic moment of the electron, searching for electron EDMs, and then doing anti-hydrogen experiments to test fundamental symmetries. And we also have Brian Odom there, who does precision molecular spectroscopy with ions, looking for time variations in fundamental constants. And we're currently searching for a fourth person to join us as of this moment, actually. So in our lab, the theme is sort of grouped into the area of what I call resonance sensors. So we use a couple of different kinds of techniques to look for new physics. So one of which I'll tell you about today involves using a really high-quality mechanical oscillator, which is basically an optically levitated nanoparticle, and we're using this to do experiments searching for deviations from gravity at short distances. Another kind of high-quality resonance sensor we use involves spin resonance. In particular, we're setting up an experiment that will be based on NMR. In laser polarized gases, where the idea is to detect new spin-dependent forces, and the target is to look for the QCD axion in particular. So for the outline for today, I'm going to spend the first half telling you about our efforts to look for corrections to gravity at short distances using these levitated nanoparticles as sensitive force detectors, and then I'll talk about our ongoing efforts to develop the Ariadne experiment, which is going to look for the axion as a force mediator, which produces spin-dependent forces. And then I'll talk about some new ideas that we had recently for searching for ultralight scalar dark matter using interferometers at the end. So on the gravity side, we're motivated primarily by the hierarchy problem. So again, looking at the relative strength of the standard model forces for two protons inside the nucleus, you have this huge, ridiculous disparity of energy scales here, where you have 10 to the 36 difference between the gravitational force versus the electromagnetic force. And this, of course, has spurred a lot of theoretical activity to try to solve this mystery. Several of these solutions tend to suggest that if you measure gravity at really short distances, that the nature of the one of our gravitational potential will actually be modified below some distance scale. And so people typically write that as this Yukawa kind of correction. Is there, let's see, is there a pointer somewhere? Or,
behind you.
Oh, a stick, okay, yeah. So where one has the ordinary Newtonian gravitational potential, the product of the masses divided by the separation distance times Newton's constant, and then this term in parentheses here is a correction due to new physics, where there could be new particles that would arise either from supersymmetry or string theory, or from particles being in large extra dimensions in space. So they would tend to produce this correction with some strength parameter alpha. This is just some dimensionless number characterizing the strength relative to one, which is the strength of gravity. And then there's some natural length scale for these interactions, which is basically the Compton wavelength of the particle that's being exchanged, which in these theories sort of has a expected value at the millimeter scale or below. So let's look at the landscape for these kind of corrections to gravity over a wide range of distances. And so here on the yes.
You might be all dead. I was just going to ask, I've heard a lot of justifications for about what R should be in that parameter, but that alpha, is there any reason to think it would be bigger than 1 or less than 1 or bigger than 52? I mean, like...
Yes, it depends on what type of physics you're looking at, right? So a lot of things you expect to couple with roughly gravitational strength, so alpha order 1, But there are other examples where you naturally expect it to be much stronger than gravity. One example would be if you have vector particles in large extra dimensions, then you expect that alpha roughly to be the difference of the ratio of the fundamental scale to the proton mass squared, which could naturally be like 10 to the 8. So in some cases, you can get things that are, you know, many, many times higher than 1. So if I go look at now the length scale for these, or the landscape for these corrections over a variety of lengths. So here's, on the x-axis, I have this range lambda plotted all the way from astrophysical kind of planetary distances down to about a tenth of a micron at the laboratory scale. And on the vertical scale, I have this strength parameter alpha. And so you see by far the best limits on this 1 over r form of the potential come from precision lunar laser ranging experiments at sort of Earth-Moon distances, where we know that there's basically no correction here at the level of, say, a part in 10 of the 10, which is actually, you know, pretty good. But if you look down now at the laboratory scale, we see this experimental plot really starts to go up really, really quickly. And in fact, at a tenth of a micron, you can actually reverse the sign of the exponent. And you can have something here where it's 10 billion times stronger than gravity, and there'd be no experimental evidence to rule it out. And so the reason it's really hard to rule things out at the short distances has to basically do with the scaling of the gravitational force. If I take,
To be fair, when you go down the plot, at some point you have also astrophysics that kicks in, right? So if you have a light mediator that mediates a force, It will be produced in stars or stuff like that. So it will cool too much stars. This bound typically are complementary, no? So.
Yeah, so these are bounds from kind of, you know, directly measuring the gravitational interaction between. So depending on the...
There are no bounds at all.
No, that's right. That's right. They're astrophysical or, in some cases...
Typically, those are for couplings 10 to the 8 times stronger than gravity, so that would be alpha of 10 to the 16. So they'd be far in the plot.
No.
Well, there are particles that are candidates that... We'll continue that discussion.
I mean, this is not coupling, this is coupling squared, right?
I agree. I mean, it will not go down as this. It will not go down till 10 to the minus 6, but it will be another number. For sure, 1 would be called.
No, not 1, because then gravitons would be emitting and cool down stars.
Yeah. There is no way you can.
This is not Yukawa coupling of 1. This is Yukawa coupling normalized built to the strength of gravity.
Alpha is normalized to
Yeah, I have G Newton up front, right? So right, this is 1 times gravity at this length, right? Okay, so the reason it's hard though in the laboratory to test that has to do with the way the gravitational force scales. So if I take 2 masses of radius r and bring them as close together as possible, if I plug in the fact that the mass has a finite density and size, then the Newtonian force between them basically goes like the positive fourth power of the size scale of the system. So if you shrink the system down, this force gets weak very, very rapidly. And so if I find material around that's as dense as I can find on Earth, which is about 20 grams per cubic centimeter, then at the length scale, say around 10 microns, which is experimentally interesting, the force involved here between the 2 masses is 10 to the minus 21 newtons, which is rather small. So to give you a sense of scale, that is about the force exerted by a single virus particle if it were to land on your shoulder in the Earth's gravitational field, and then divide that number by 100, and that's the size of this effect. Or in more practical terms, this is about 10 billion times more sensitive than a typical atomic force microscope measures, where you measure forces on atoms in condensed matter experiments. So while the gravitational force is getting very small, at the same time, the electromagnetic forces are getting stronger as you get things close together. And one of the things that we need to worry about in these experiments is the Casimir effect. So if I have neutral conducting parallel plates, even with no electrical potential difference, There is a macroscopic force between them due to quantum vacuum fluctuations that goes like the fourth power of the separation distance between the plates. This gets very strong rapidly as you get objects closer together at the order of micron kind of length scales. In addition, we're worried about other background electromagnetic forces from what are known as patch potentials. So even in quote-unquote good conductors, you have local variations in the work function over the surface of a material, and you can have local areas where the potential electrical potential actually varies over the surface of materials, and that can lead to spurious signals where you have an electromagnetic force, which can in some cases be much stronger than the gravitational force at the distance you're trying to probe. So now I want to zoom in back on that parameter space, but now focus more on the left side of the plot, really zooming in on the experimental length scale. And so this is, again, this Yukawa-type correction of the potential, going from 100 microns down to about 10 nanometers. And the alpha parameter here now only has a positive exponent, where at the bottom is something of 1 times gravitational strength, and at the top is 10 to the 15 times gravitational strength. The area in the yellow here is what's excluded by experiment currently. So at the sort of tens of microns of length scale, the best constraints come from precision torsion balance experiments done at the University of Washington, where we have a torsion pendulum and then some attractor mass underneath it, and then the torque on that pendulum is measured at these tens of micron distances. At the length scale of about 10 microns, the best limits come from micro cantilever experiments where one can take a cantilever beam and put a mass on it and measure the interaction between that mass and another mass that's brought nearby. At distances less than 10 microns, the best measurements come from Casimir effect measurements, where basically you can adapt those experimental apparatuses to nullify part of the Casimir force signal and then get limits at sort of the 1 micron length scale. The shaded areas to the left in the purple or in the pink and green area are some of the predictions from the theories I mentioned earlier, including things like moduli or particles in the bulk of X-ray dimensions.
Sorry, what's the gauge baryon? Is that gauge baryon number? Plot?
Yeah, so the idea is you have baryons that would propagate into the bulk of X-ray dimensions. So in addition to you're probably familiar with the large extra dimensions models, right? So in addition to the graviton, you could have other particles, scalars, vectors in the bulk of the extra dimensions. And for example, if you gauge baryon number, then you can have the baryon number gauge field propagate into the extra dimensions. And this would be the constraint or the rough prediction for its interaction.
I see.
So there are several different types of particles in these theories, which you can look at as sort of targets in this unexplored part of the parameter space. And one can ask, what can we do to really improve the sensitivity of these techniques to try to get down and explore more of that area? And so let's look at one example of these sensors. So these are all mechanical sensors based on some sort of mechanical element, whether it's a torsion fiber or cantilever beam or a torsion oscillator. Let's look at the cantilever beam and see what's limiting the sensitivity of the measurement. So the cantilever beam is basically like a spring. It's basically a diving board. You apply a force to the tip, and you get some displacement. And if you know the spring constant, then by measuring the displacement, you can infer what the applied force was. And so if I apply a force as a function of frequency, here's a plot that Mina showed on the blackboard yesterday, actually. The amplitude response is depending on the frequency, where if you apply a force at the resonance frequency of the beam, you get a very large enhancement of the amplitude. And that is due to the mechanical quality factor Q of the oscillator, which is a measure of the inverse dissipation in the system. So on resonance, then we can excite this beam into a very large amplitude for a very small force, which is a nice way of getting a measurable signal in these experiments. And the Q factors of these kind of oscillators can be quite large, on the order of 10 to the 5 or greater. One of the things that fundamentally limits the sensitivity of this is thermal Brownian motion. And so there's a nice analogy you can think about with a piece of dust that's being kicked around as it moves through a fluid, where fluid molecules come and give it random momenta as the molecules recoil from the particle. So similarly, you have this cantilever beam. It's in some contact with a thermal bath at some finite temperature. And we know from Stat-Mech, from the equidistant theorem, there's a relation between the expectation value of x squared, which depends on that temperature. So from that, you can derive that in the presence of those random thermal kicks, there's a minimum force I can detect on top of those random thermal kicks. And that minimum force is described in this formula here. So it goes like the thermal energy kT times the spring constant of the cantilever times the measurement bandwidth B, all divided by the product of the mechanical quality factor and the mechanical frequency, all to the 1/2 power. And so to put some numbers in for oscillators like the cantilever beams that I mentioned that were used in that gravitational experiment, so here we have a silicon cantilever beam. It has a width of 50 microns, a length of 250 microns, and a thickness of only 1/3 of a micron. So this device in a cryogenic environment gives a quality factor of about 10 to the 5 and a sensitivity that's about 10 times 10 to the minus 18, or 10 attonewtons per root hertz. And so you can ask, well, what is it we can do to improve the sensitivity of this type of sensor? So one thing we can see is that since it depends inversely on the square root of this mechanical quality factor, one approach would be to improve that dissipation, to reduce the friction in the system. And so in these kind of oscillators, there's a few things that are producing some limitations on that mechanical quality factor. There's the fact that I have this mechanical oscillator that's attached to, it's clamped to some surface, and energy can flow out into that substrate. There is the possibility of surface imperfections along the material, as well as the fundamental internal materials loss from processes like thermoelastic dissipation, where the material basically flexes and then you can have heat transferring through the material. So as a way of getting around those limitations, one can think about actually optically levitating the force sensor rather than using the solid state type of force sensor. And so the idea here is you can take a dielectric particle, so in our case we'll be looking at a nanosphere made out of silica glass, and that dielectric particle, it has some polarizability. So in the laser field, in a laser field, it acquires a dipole moment, which then couples back into the laser with the laser to give you a dipole potential, which depends like the electric field of the laser squared with a minus sign here. So the electric field of the laser squared is basically the intensity of the light. And so you can create an optical potential for that polarizable dielectric particle, where the particle tends to be fixed at the location of the maximal light intensity. So if I focus light down to a point, I can create an optical potential that can confine such a dielectric particle. And then the idea is now you can measure the motion of that particle, of the center mass of that particle, in this optical container, if you like, and use that as your oscillator that you're interrogating rather than the mechanical solid-state cantilever beam. And so when you do that, then you've now decoupled the center of mass oscillation from the environment in a very good way, where we no longer have any clamping to any sort of solid substrate, and we no longer need to be concerned, as long as the particle is rigid enough, we don't need to be concerned with the internal materials loss properties in the particle. Yeah, question?
Is frequency tunability important? Like if you gain...
Yeah, that's another feature of this approach, right, is that you can actually control the frequency of the trap by adjusting the laser intensity up to a point, and so it's a lot more flexible than this. Where here the mechanics are basically the geometry of the device is setting the frequency. So depending on what you're trying to do, that can be useful for different things.
Yeah. Does your Q, it sounds like the frequency depends on your laser power here, right?
Yes.
And getting a very high Q, where your frequency depends on the laser power, which probably isn't that constant, is that hard? That sounds hard.
Yeah, so you do need to stabilize the laser intensity within the mechanical line width. So if you have a really high Q oscillator, you have to make sure the laser intensity is stable enough that the particle stays on resonance.
And that means stable to a part in 100,000 or something, if your Q...
Well, depending on what Q you work with. As you'll see, we have techniques of solving that problem, but you're right that's one of the things you do worry about. Okay, so now we can look at this levitated particle and now look at the projected sensitivity of such a thing. And so now I'm rewritten my formula here for that minimum detectable thermal force just in a slightly simpler way. It's the same formula, but now it's written in terms of the mass of the trapped nanoparticle. And this gamma is the damping coefficient. In this case, we're assuming that damping is coming strictly from collisions with the background gas, in a high vacuum environment. So here I'm assuming that I'm at a pressure of a respectable UHV environment, about 10 to the minus 10 torr, and I have a temperature of the environment still at room temperature, 300 K. Now here's a plot of that force sensitivity as a function of the size of the particle. And so for particles of size kind of micron and below, you can get into this regime where the force sensitivity is of order 10 to the minus 21 newtons per hertz, which is right in the range we need it to be for these interesting gravitational tests. Similarly, I can also cast it as an acceleration sensitivity, and then in fact for particles larger than about a micron, you can push down into the regime where you can look at nano g, a few nano g per hertz kind of acceleration sensitivity.
I can just imagine pushing the pressure down further fairly easily. Does that affect the sensitivity much?
Easily maybe a stretch. It's already a pretty good vacuum. You could go down lower in pressure. At some point, you'll see quantum effects start to cause limitations here, and I'll explain that in a second. Actually, so this what I'm showing here in this dotted line. It corresponds to this equation one from the background gas collisions. As the particle gets larger, you start to see this curve actually deviate from that line. That is due to scattering of the discrete laser photons in the trap, where you have a process where the recoiling photons from Rayleigh scattering are kicking the particle around and giving you some kind of momentum diffusion process, which is like a heating mechanism, basically. And eventually, that will provide some limit. If I were to keep lowering the pressure, I'd be limited by that laser. And that's true even for a completely quiet laser with shot noise limited laser.
And
Penny? Yeah?
Is this still far off from quantum projection noise? Zero-point motion in the trap?
Yeah, so here I don't need to be, right, I'm not limited at all by...
not even for like the smallest?
No, so here, so you don't need to be, the thing doesn't need to be cold. This is all, this can be thermal, right? So I don't...
No, but there's still 0-point motion in the trap.
Yeah, so this is a limitation due to the thermal sensitivity at room temperature. Right, so we're average number of quanta are very, very high, 10 to the 8 or something like that, right? So we're nowhere near the 0-point motion. We're not displacement limited here, right?
Okay. What's the frequency of the particle in the trap?
So it depends on the intensity, but we typically run order 10 kilohertz, something like that. So I'll show more on that in a bit. So already back in 2013, there was some experimental demonstration at the level of about 20 zemtonewtons per hertz using these levitated systems. The cantilever beams I mentioned earlier are somewhere up here, so several orders of magnitude off from where these... What was that?
7
minus 21, yeah, that's right. And as I mentioned already, this deviation here is due to this quantum effect from what's known as photon recoil heating, which will eventually give you some more fundamental limit. So given this fantastic sensitivity, then one can try to do an experiment to measure gravity, which is what we're doing in our lab. Basically, here's the cartoon version of the experiment. You have an optical cavity where I have one ordinary dielectric mirror. On the other side of the cavity, I have a gold-coated silicon nitride membrane, which is a very thin mirror. And then behind the mirror, I have a device, which is the drive mass for the experiment, which sources the gravitational signal. It is a silicon wafer that has sections of gold embedded into it. So basically what you have here is a density modulation between gold and silicon on this device, which then moves up and down in this direction. And that puts a force on a sub-wavelength nanoparticle, which is trapped in this optical standing wave trap in the cavity at a location that's close to that end mirror. And so this gravitational force between this drive mass device behind this mirror is modulated as I move this up and down, and that creates a signal on the trapped nanoparticle. We arrange that so that it excites the particle at its resonance frequency in the optical trap, which then causes it to oscillate into a large amplitude that I can then read out according to the phase of the light that exits from the cavity. And so what I have, this rigid mirror here basically acts like a screen to block the electromagnetic forces from this device from striking the nanoparticle, but the gravitational modulated force is still able to act on the particle even in the presence of that thin membrane. And so we're projecting with this experiment that we can get a new limit at sort of the micron length scale that would be improved by a few orders of magnitude relative to where the current experiments are, and start to carve into some of this other parameter space for searching for these new particles. And so the actual experimental apparatus looks a little more like this. So you have this axis here is the optical cavity. This is the mirror behind which we have our drive mass device that moves back and forth. We have another optical trap that's created by what we call the dipole beams. These are at 90 degrees with respect to that optical cavity trap. So we can initially catch the particle in this dipole trap and then transfer it into this optical cavity trap. We also have a set of other lasers that we use to laser cool the motion of the particle when it's in the trap. So here's the test mass for the experiment. Here's the SEM picture. It's 300 nanometers across a silica particle of glass that we catch in this trap. And then the actual photo of the vacuum system looks more like that. So you have the dipole beams coming along this axis. Here's the cavity. The drive mass actuator is mounted on a device here that moves up and down behind this mirror over here. So the drive mass itself, we fabricate using a silicon wafer, as I mentioned. So we basically etch trenches into the silicon wafer, and then we electroplate gold into the trenches, and then also electroplate it above the surface up to a certain amount. After we do that, we have this kind of corrugated pattern here from the gold deposition, which we actually don't want, because then the electromagnetic force would also in principle be modulated at the same period of this density modulation, just because of the fact that the surface has that ripple in it. So in order to mitigate that, then we take our silicon wafer and we actually glue a glass substrate to the top of this thing and then turn it upside down, and then basically polish away the silicon from the backside. This is a technique that was developed back in our experiments at Stanford with the cantilever experiment. So basically we then polish away that silicon. Here's a picture taken with a focused ion beam taking a cross section of this during the middle of that polishing process, where now we're removing away the silicon wafer. And what's left on the top here is a flat surface. We stop this process basically when the there's only a micron or two of remaining silicon above that, above those gold trenches, and then we can coat the top surface with a layer of uniform gold to give a nice signal, to give a relatively background-free surface of the drive mass. So that drive mass is then mounted onto a MEMS actuator, which is basically a capacitively driven cantilever beam that we fabricate. Where this device now can move on that beam and then oscillate up and down with an amplitude of about 5 microns, which is enough to modulate the force over the range that we're interested in. So we catch the particle in, as I mentioned, in an optical trap that's originally this dipole optical trap. This is an optical trap where we take two counterpropagating beams and focus them near the same point and create a optical potential where the particle can be trapped near the focus of those lasers. So we have these lasers that are primarily polarized or in orthogonal directions from the two sides, but we let some of the other polarization in, or some of the same polarization in from the opposite side. That allows me to get a little bit of optical interference here, and so what I actually wind up with is a standing wave optical trap. This is now the force along the beam direction here is a function of distance as I go through this focus. And so if I zoom in on that center section, due to the interference, I basically create a shallow standing wave or shallow optical lattice trap where I can keep the particle in many, many possible trapping sites along this axis of the laser. And so, in fact, when I catch a particle here, I can image its motion, and then by hitting with another laser, I can actually kick it from one of these sites to an adjacent site, for example. So in order to get the particle in that trap, we have to somehow launch it from somewhere. And so what we do is take a quartz substrate that we deposit a bunch of these nanoparticles on, and we shake the substrate with a large acceleration to basically free them loose and have them kind of fall down and hopefully land up in the optical trap. And so this is a non-trivial problem, it turns out. The acceleration that you need to knock one of these tiny particles off of a surface actually goes like 1 over r squared, the size of the particle squared, for in order to break the van der Waals interaction between the surface and the particle. And so the acceleration applied to the substrate is actually 10 to the 7 g in order to knock this thing off. And so that is a level at which, if you shook it much harder, we start to break the piezo ceramic ring that we're using in the substrate itself and so forth. But sure enough, we actually measure this acceleration. And when we reach that acceleration, we're able to launch these particles. Here's a little movie if you want to see kind of what it looks like when we catch them. This is a quartz enclosure that we used for some of our early experiments. So we have two counterpropagating lasers here. This is scattering the lasers off the sides of our container. There is a substrate here that's containing these nanoparticles, and gravity is actually pointing to the right in the picture. So we're going to shake this substrate. The particles are going to fall down to the right, and you can kind of see here, if I can get this movie to work. So as the particles are falling down, then they're falling through the laser, and eventually they'll find their way to the focus here where there's a trap. In this case, we had a couple of them that kind of landed in the same trap and kind of got into some rotational state. So we generally try to set it up so we're only catching one particle for the experiment. And so this movie is not sped up at all. This is in real time. And so you can see here that these particles are not falling like you'd normally expect if you were to drop them under gravity. And in fact, we need to have some way of keeping their velocity slow so that when they land in the optical trap, they'll actually stick in it. And so what we're doing here is leaving some background gas in this system. So we actually operate with a gas of a couple of torr of nitrogen. And so then the idea is to use that nitrogen gas to take away the energy so the particle can actually get stuck in the optical potential rather than just falling straight through it. And so then once you have the particle in the trap, you can then pump out the air, and when you do so, then you'll reduce the friction and then be able to realize the high sensitivity.
Question.
So, yeah.
How much charge is left on the spheres when you launch
it? Yeah, so that's a good question. So normally there is no charge. Occasionally we have one or two extra electrons. For bigger size particles, we've seen we get more charges. But I'll have some more data on that, actually, I'll show in a sec. So in order to realize the sensitivity I was mentioning, you need to pump the air out. You can't leave that gas in there. It would damp the system. And so it turned out that our group and many other groups noticed a problem where the particle was getting lost as you pump the air out of the system. And so we've done some work to try to study and understand why that is. And so we think the answer may have something to do with what are called radiometric forces. And so this is an experiment that's kind of a modern version of an experiment done in the 1800s by Crookes. And Crookes had thought he had discovered radiation pressure. So what you have here is a partially evacuated glass jar here with this device with these vanes on it that can spin. And one side is highly reflective, and the other side of each vane is dark and highly absorbing. And so the force from radiation pressure, if you shine light at this thing, would actually be more strong on the reflecting side due to the fact that the momentum of the photon gets reversed when it hits the surface and bounces back than it would be on the dark side. But in fact, this thing is actually spinning the wrong way. So Crookes thought he had discovered radiation pressure. In fact, he did not discover it. What he did discover here is what are known as radiometric forces. And so the idea is that hot black surface absorbs more of the laser light than the shiny reflective surface. And therefore, the gas molecules that bump into it pick up more kinetic energy after hitting that hot surface. And this can create a current of the gas molecules, which then can push on this thing harder than the forces of the radiation pressure and actually cause it to spin the wrong way. And in these optical traps, we think that these instabilities that we've seen and other groups have seen are actually due to a similar effect, where basically you have a nanoparticle that's in a laser trap which has an intensity profile. And so you can have some part of the sphere surface hotter than another part of the sphere surface, which can create a current of gas molecules which can knock the particle out of the trap, even though the trapping depth that you calculate from the radiation pressure in some cases can exceed 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin. These instabilities are strong enough that the particle can still get kicked out. And so this is important when the mean free path of the gas is basically of order the object size. So you can calculate that force, And so here's a graph just showing that radiometric or photothermal force as a function of pressure. Just focus on the solid line. So the solid line here is showing you that there's some range of pressure from about tens of torr down to sort of tens of millitorr over which this radiometric heating force here is relatively constant. So while you're catching the particle somewhere over here and then you're pumping the air out of the system, the damping from the background gas is decreasing as you'd expect as you remove the pressure from the system, whereas this radiometric force is staying flat. And so the center mass temperature over the same range of the particles actually heating up as you're pumping the gas out until eventually that heating rate overcomes this gas damping rate and the particle gets kicked out. And so in order to solve that, you need to add some additional damping in the system. And the way we do that is using what we call laser feedback cooling. So we do that in three dimensions. So basically we take the particle and we catch it in this optical trap, and then we image its motion onto a segmented photodetector. And from that we can get the instantaneous position of the particle. We can take the signal from the position and phase shift it to get the velocity of the particle. And then taking that velocity, we can then feed back to another set of lasers in three dimensions, which basically modulate some radiation pressure force to basically add back damping in the system to replace the damping lost by the gas. So you might worry that if I'm putting damping back in the system, I'm going to also suffer in terms of my force sensitivity. But it turns out that's not actually true. The force sensitivity that I can attain goes like this ratio, the square root of the ratio temperature over the quality factor. And so while I am, in fact, decreasing my mechanical quality factor using this laser feedback cooling, I'm also reducing the temperature by basically roughly the same factor. And so I get to basically preserve the same force sensitivity I would have had with the really high mechanical quality factor. And another thing this allows me to do is to basically tune the quality factor that I'm effectively working with, which can alleviate the concern, David, that you mentioned earlier about the maintaining the laser intensity very, very, very narrow, because in fact I don't actually need to work with a really, really narrow oscillate line width oscillator as long as I'm Colden. So once you apply this, then you can pump the air out all the way into the high vacuum limit, and you can actually nearly turn off the feedback cooling once you're in the high vacuum limit, which really shows that these gas mechanisms I was mentioning earlier are responsible for, in some part, for that instability. So once you're in that limit, though, then you can measure forces at the zepto-Newton level. This is the measured force integrated now for averaging time of 10 to the 5 seconds, where we've shown that our system is quiet enough to reach forces at the level of a few times 10 to the 21 newtons, or 6 zepto-Newtons in this case. With a sensitivity of about 1 atom newton per hertz, which is limited by just the technical laser intensity noise in that data. And so it's also nice to be able to calibrate your sensitivity so that you're not relying on too many assumptions. We'd like to be sure that we're actually measuring a force that small. In particular, if we're trying to rule out new physics related to gravity, I'd like to be able to apply a really tiny force and see that I can actually see it. And so one way we can do that is actually using an electrostatic calibration. So as I mentioned already, the beads are about 90% of the time neutral electrically, and they tend to stay that way over many days. But occasionally we'll catch a particle that has either 1 or 2 extra electrons on it. And inside my optical cavity, I have a set of electrodes that I can use to apply a known electric field. And then so for particles that have either 1 or 2 extra electrons, we can then measure the force in that electric field and use that to sort of calibrate the sensitivity of the system. And so it's also possible to do the calibration on the neutral particles, and we can do that using the fact that I have this optical lattice trap where there are many different sites where I can keep the particle trapped. So in particular, if I cause the particle to jump from one of those sites to an adjacent site, then I know the distance here between those trapping positions is half of the wavelength of the laser, which in our case is about 500 nanometers. And so from that, I can then use that as a ruler, essentially, to give me some distance scale for the motion of the particle. And so we've shown that that's consistent with the electrostatic calibration as well. And so then once you have the particle in this regime, you can get the sensitivity. The idea is to, now we can transfer it from that original trap into a trap that's in this optical cavity where the gravity measurements will be taking place. So we have two lasers in this cavity, one of which traps the particle and the other one can both cool it and read out its center mass motion. And so we had the particle now in that trap. Here's a photo of the particle in the cavity trap. These are the electrodes. The cavity beams come along this axis. So the experiment is currently being reconstructed after moving our lab. So it'll probably be a couple months before we have this back up and running again. But we're hoping to hopefully soon get some preliminary data with the particle near the surface with the driving mass on. So I wanted to mention a couple of other possible applications related to gravity with these things just very briefly. So one thing you can do with this experiment is gravitational wave detection. So yesterday we heard a little bit about bar detectors, like for example, introduced in the 60s by Joe Weber. So this is sort of an optical analog of that in some way, where basically one can imagine having a optical cavity that's, say, much shorter in length than, say, the LIGO-type interferometers. Now we're thinking of lengths ranging from, say, 10 to 100 meters. And inside this cavity, then you can trap a nanoparticle. And if a gravitational wave comes along and acts on the system, it can change the physical distance between the mirrors of my cavity, just like it would in LIGO. But when that happens, then it moves the antinode where the particle is trapped relative to where the particle is. And so that puts a force on the particle which can cause it to oscillate in that optical potential. And you can arrange a resonance, just like here, we have this aluminum bar that's like a bell that rings when the gravity wave frequency matches the resonance here. You can arrange it so the optical frequency of the trap is actually tuned into resonance with the passing gravitational wave, where now the laser intensity actually makes this kind of a very widely tunable version of this thing. So if a gravitational wave comes along, it can then ring up an oscillation of the particle in that potential, and you can get pretty good sensitivity due to the very good environmental decoupling. And so for a 100-meter cavity, you can get strain sensitivities of order 10 minus 22 per hertz at the high frequency end of the spectrum around, say, 100 kilohertz with a disk-shaped geometry. The difference here compared to LIGO is that this system is limited by the thermal Brownian noise, not the laser shot noise. So LIGO is basically, I like to think about it as doing a position measurement of the end mirror's distance. Here we're turning that position measurement into a force measurement. And because we're doing that, we have a different frequency scaling than they do. So if you look at the strain sensitivity of LIGO and advanced LIGO as a function of frequency on the high frequency part, this is not usually the range you see in these plots. This is 10 to the 4 hertz up to 10 to the 5 hertz and up. The LIGO style interferometers are limited by photon shot noise. They're actually getting worse as the frequency increases, whereas because we're limited by the thermal Brownian noise, our sensitivity is actually improving as the frequency increases. And there's some range over which this technique could beat the sensitivity of advanced LIGO in a relatively compact system. Question?
Can I just go back to this? Can I just confirm? Well, my understanding is that cavity is 100 meters long, and you have a single nanoparticle somewhere near the end. I mean, the question's kind of obvious, right? But
Right. You could have more than one if you have different trapping sites with different frequencies, for example, because if the laser has a profile, so you could kind of multiplex the readout.
Would you win more even if you just had 1,000? Do you get 1,000 times the signal to noise? And they're all the same.
But I guess then you'd look at a sort of independent oscillators and you'd average, you could image their motion collectively, yeah, sure. But it might make more sense to have several different oscillators of different frequencies so you could scan over a different...
It goes like the square root of the number of
oscillators. That would go like the square root, yeah. Yeah, so from the strain sensitivity here, as I was saying, gets better at high frequency rather than low frequency. And the one caveat, of course, there may not be so many conventional astrophysics sources above 10 kilohertz. If you look at sort of a natural limit, maybe if you had, say, solar mass black holes, you might expect there to be a cutoff somewhere around, say, 30 kilohertz. There could also maybe be some higher harmonics and so forth that would show up at the higher end. But I think a more interesting thing to look at with this kind of thing would be beyond the standard model physics. So, for example, there's a process where around black holes, you can have a collection of scalar particles, particularly the QCD axion, can form a cloud around black holes through the black hole super radiance mechanism, where then you have this, basically what you produce is a kind of a monochromatic long-lived source of gravitational waves, which could naturally sit in frequencies above the 10 kilohertz range. And then there's some other ideas as well, or perhaps another way to reason is just the fact that now that we've seen gravitational waves, it's interesting to just explore what sort of frequencies they might be out there.
And you said long, you sort of said some words about this, but what's the bandwidth of this detector? I mean, what I'm wondering about is that the gravitational waves I've seen, obviously just in the papers, are like, their Q is low, it's like 8.
Yeah.
You see a few wavelengths, and it sounds to me like this is a highly resonant detector, which has a high Q, which you importantly imagine.
It has a high Q, much like this guy has a high Q.
Sure.
But then, just like there was a discussion yesterday about this, I guess you were absent for. There are ways of basically improving your effective bandwidth. So here you have this tunable Q factor based on how much cooling you do, and you can basically broaden the resonance to the point to open the bandwidth up more than say at the part in 10 of the 10 level or whatever you have from that. So yeah, there's some, you do have to worry about that, but it's a resonant detector, and you're trying to use the resonance to basically bring the signal from the motion of the particle way above the shot noise detection limit, where you're limited by the Brownian noise limit. But it is a consideration. So I think in practice you may want to keep the Q maybe at 100 or 1,000 or something like that, so that you're not really, you know, relying on detecting a super narrow line.
By the way, I mean, some of these source, especially for sporadians, they're continuous monochromatic sources, so they're not transient sources like the actual light. Merger events are transient, so the frequency drifts very fast as the signal passes through your band. So it's more like an impulse for resonant detectors, while these, for example, superadians will appear like a monochromatic signal, but you can average the noise down.
And what's the Q of that signal?
Ridiculously high.
So you could average three.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is you need to scan frequencies too. So this is why, I mean, when we were thinking about, we're also imagining to trap several beats, that also helps with frequency coverage because different positions have different types of frequencies.
Yeah, so you'd probably have several beads, and then you'd also modulate the intensity in some way to kind of sweep over the frequencies so that you get a continuous coverage.
But it's that high Q that's so tempting. If this thing has a ring down time of years, you know, then you want something that's...
No, the Q is what Andy said, so the feedback pooling...
Do you mean the Q of the source?
The source.
Yeah, well that will be the same, right? So you can sit parked there at that frequency, and your sensitivity doesn't depend on the Q of the measurement. So, right, so I can park my detector at that resonance frequency, even with my relatively poor Q, as long as I've cooled, you know, to compensate and get the same sensitivity I would have had with the high Q on the sensor, right?
True. Isn't there some way you lose by the square root?
Well, the temperature goes down by the same factor.
Oh. Yeah, so Andy, what is your T over Q ratio that you get? You say that's constant, right?
Yeah, so, right, so I guess at room temperature, I guess, well, I'm not sure what units you want. Your Q would be effectively, I mean, in the optimistic case, could be as high as like 10 to the 11.
At
300K. At 300K, yeah.
Can I ask a practical question about actually
yes.
the short distance stuff from before? How do you get the bead up super close to the mirror in that last antenna?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a couple ways we're looking at playing with moving the bead around. So one of which is you can tilt the potential essentially by hitting it with another laser and then recooling it, so you can kind of make it take steps along the lattice. And I showed one example of that. That's one of the ones. The other thing we're thinking about doing is chirping the frequencies to see if we can cause there to be some kind of... So that's something we're still trying to figure out. So in terms of implementation for the gravitational wave system, we're thinking about there might be ways of doing this in a more inexpensive way where we actually use a fiber-based cavity, provided we can get the fiber noise low enough at these frequencies to do the measurement. So the idea would be to trap a particle in a free space cavity that's only a few millimeters long, and then you have 100 meter long a fiber with a reflector on one side. You don't need a very high finesse, something like 10 or something would be fine. And so if this winds up being low enough noise, then this might be a compact, relatively inexpensive way to actually realize one of these sensors. And so we have a collaboration now with a group from Peter Barker's group in University College London, where we're now looking at potentially developing these fiber-based type traps.
There's a gravitational wave hitting this thing, is that right? And is it, does it matter? What is the conversation we have to do with fiber? It makes my brain hurt. Like,
yeah, so again, there's a strain, right? It's a high-frequency signal looking for again, right? So there's some strain where I'm going to basically modulate the length of the fiber, or the fiber cavity, essentially, right?
But the fiber has to be stretched out in one direction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not coiled up. No, it's not coiled up. Yeah, you still need the length. You just don't need a huge mirror, maybe. So the 100-meter cavity would require a pretty big optic for the proposal we originally had. And if you could do this with this fiber, then you don't need any big optics. You still need a vacuum system, and you still need a long thing.
The fiber doesn't introduce noise.
It does, and that's something that we're looking at, yeah. There are definitely, and so that we're doing some experiments to see how crazy it is. Okay, so these techniques, I just want to briefly mention, so these techniques were all kind of in the classical regime, where I'm not looking at any quantum behavior of the trapped particle itself. It's interesting to think about what you might be able to gain by getting to the quantum regime. So, for example, for individual atoms, people have been in the quantum regime for trapped atoms now for many decades. We have really good quantum control over the internal states of atoms, but also the motional states, so we can really access the quantum harmonic oscillator for the motion of trapped atoms in various kinds of traps and ions. And so it's been suggested that these levitated particles can also be in the quantum regime mechanically. And there were some proposals that came out about a little less than a decade ago, and now a few handful of experiments popping up that are trying to realize basically cooling the mechanical degrees of freedom of this center mass all the way down to the quantum ground state, to the zero point of the potential. And so we're doing an experiment that I'm not going to tell you anything about today, but I just want to briefly mention it, where we're trying to actually use cold atoms as a coolant to basically cool the motion of a 170-nanometer glass particle. On paper, we can cool this thing all the way down to the ground state. In the lab, we'll see how well it works. But if we're able to do that, then one potential thing one could do in the future would be to actually look at quantum effects, where we're going to use matter wave interference in these systems. And so, for example, here's a proposal where you can keep a particle, say, next to a surface. Say, I have in mind here, again, one of these gravitational measurements, where we trap the particle and then essentially cool it near that quantum ground state. Then we can release this trap, and the particle will fall. We can diffract it off of a light grating and then measure its position at some later time. And do this experiment over and over again, I'll generate some interference pattern where the location of these fringes will actually depend on the acceleration of the particle near a surface. So I can do this to actually realize an accelerometer with acceleration sensitivity at the nano-g level that's also localized at kind of the micron length scale. And in the future, it's possible to maybe get a substantial improvement in these new forces at the kind of tens of micron length scale using that. So for the last
reference, for the current experiments, what's the thermal occupation number?
10 to the 8-ish or something like that. Oh, but when I cool, yeah, so we're cooling down to maybe 10 to the 4, something like that. I think the record for a levitated particle is about 60 right now from a different lab. Okay, so in the last 20-ish minutes or so, I wanted to just talk about some of our other efforts related now to...
Yeah. For the 60 phonon occupancy, what's the size of the particle?
That particle, I think, is about 140 or 150 nanometers, so it's roughly the same order, yeah, a little smaller.
Okay. So the upper limit seems like it's about 150 nanometers with some standard launching techniques. If I wanted to cool to the ground state,
I think it's actually, with the launching tag, it's actually easier to go to the bigger particles.
Awesome.
Launching becomes harder for the small particles. And in fact, the group that I mentioned that has the 60 quanta, they have a different launching mechanism that actually use a nebulizer to aerosolize a particle in a fluid, and there's different techniques people use. But it's relatively easy to get micron-sized particles.
So, who is this?
Lucas Novotny from, where is he at? Zurich, Switzerland.
And the gravitational wave has no benefit from a small particle, right?
No. But it does need to be, it does have to fit inside a, for that, at least for that implementation, it has to fit inside an antinode of the,
so
of the laser
wavelength.
Trap.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so with the last part of my talk, I want to now turn to dark matter. And so, as we know, there have been a lot of dedicated searches for heavy dark matter particles, WIMPs and so forth, with so far no uncontested evidence. And so it's interesting to think about lighter dark matter candidates, one of which has been searched for to some extent, which is the axion. So we're interested in also looking for axions, which are theoretically very well generically motivated. So we're particularly interested in the QCD axion, which can solve the strong CP problem, and also potentially dark matter at the same time. So there are a number of experiments running to look for the axion as dark matter, and I guess you've heard several of those at a conference last week for those of you that were here. So the most famous of which is the ADMX experiment, which has been the longest running now, where basically one can look for conversion of axions to photons in a microwave cavity. There's the CERN solar telescope looking for solar axions, and some other more recent developing experiments looking for axion dark matter as well. So in our lab, we're interested in looking for axions, but not directly as being part of the background of dark matter, but rather looking at the axion as a particle which could mediate forces between objects, and so in particular, they can cause spin-dependent forces between objects at short distance, at distances of order as small as 30 microns, and in this way, we can kind of source the axion field locally in the lab. So our experiment is called Ariadne, which is a collaboration between us as well as people at MENA here, people at Stanford, Indiana University in Bloomington, as well as the Center for Axion and Precision Physics that's recently established in Korea. And so the parameter space for the axion that we're looking at, so the axion is basically characterized according to its mass, its decay constant is related to 1 over its mass. And so for the QCD axion, you can talk about it in terms of a single parameter, which is the mass of the axion. So here is a plot showing the current constraints and some experimental search ranges for axions. So the blue areas here are what's excluded from astrophysics. So we know the axion has to be lighter than about a few times, or around 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. And so the area here on the left, depending on the model of cosmology, whether or not you have high energy scale inflation or low energy scale inflation, the axion might also be disfavored below kind of micro electron volt masses, but depending on the model, it's certainly possible to have axions that are lighter. So the range for the axion is essentially 10-ish milli electron volts and down. So the ADMX experiment I mentioned with the microwave cavity is covering this range of kind of the micro electron volt masses for the axion. The second generation is aiming to get another sort of order of magnitude up from that range. The CAST experiment has measured sort of EV range axions, and YOXO, its upgrade, is aiming to get down over a broad range here, down to kind of closing up the upper end of this open window around 10 milli electron volts. So our experiment, Ariadne, is trying to basically close part of this gap here between where the cavity experiments are cutting off and where the astrophysical bounds start. And then there are ideas for developing experiments covering the lower range that I don't have time to say much about today. But I wanted to just sort of put some of these experiments in context in a kind of a organizational chart, if you like, where we can basically think about searches for axions or axion-like particles characterized in terms of what the source is and what the coupling is. And so the ADMX experiment, as well as several other ideas and extensions of related experiments, are involved with looking for dark matter axions coupling to photons. The CASPER experiment is looking for dark matter axions coupling to nucleons. The CAST and YOXO will look for solar axions through the photon coupling. And our experiment is looking for lab-produced axions, where we have experiments like the light shining through walls on one hand looking for photons. And in our case, we're concerned with the coupling to nucleons through the virtual exchange of axions. And so the idea is you take two nucleons, you put them together, you have, in general, some scalar coupling and pseudo-scalar coupling. So the scalar coupling is roughly expected to have a term of order QCD times some mass scale that's like around 60 MeV times the axion field times the fermions times 1 over F axion. The pseudo-scalar coupling looks like a derivative coupling, which in the non-relativistic limit is like the gradient of the axion over F axion dotted into the spin sigma. So in this way, we can get a spin-dependent interaction. If I have two nucleons coming together and they exchange an axion, there's basically three kinds of terms I can write down where the axion is acting like a force mediator between the nucleons. So there's this monopole-monopole term where I have two copies of the scalar coupling at each vertex. I can also have a monopole-dipole term where I have one scalar coupling and one pseudoscalar. Or I could have the dipole coupling squared. So Ariadne, at least for its first generation, is focusing on looking for this term, where we want to basically look at the product of the scalar and the dipole couplings. And so if I have two fermions, there's this spin-dependent potential then between the mass of one fermion and the spin of another, where there's this distance dependence between them. That potential goes like sigma dot r, sigma being the spin and r being the vector separating them. There's some exponential cutoff here, which is related to lambda axion. That's the Compton wavelength of the axion. So the mass of the axion is now setting the range for how close you need to get these things together to see the force. I have this 1 over r squared like term and then the product of the coupling constants here. So because this couples to the sigma, and sigma is proportional to the magnetic moment of a fermion, we can think about this like a fictitious or effective magnetic field that's coupled into the fermion moment. But this field is not like a regular magnetic field. It doesn't obey Maxwell's equations. And what's important for our experiment, as well as I'll explain momentarily, is that this interaction is not screened by magnetic shielding in the same way that ordinary magnetic fields would be screened by magnetic shielding. And so this constraint from the astrophysics, where the mass of the axion is less than about 6 milliEV, means that this range here, lambda, should be at the 30 micron scale or off roughly from there. So one way of looking for this spin-dependent force would be to use NMR. And so one can take a spin 1/2 fermion, in particular a spin 1/2 helium 3 nucleus, and then bring a mass nearby that spin. And so now imagine you take this nucleus and you put it in an external magnetic field. Then there's some energy splitting between the spin up and spin down states that's set by the nuclear Larmor precession frequency, which then of course depends on the external field. So the idea is that when you bring this external mass nearby the spin, then that presence of the mass gives you some additional effective magnetic field, which then could modify this Larmor frequency. And so you can look for a modification of that Larmor frequency in the experiment when your mass is nearby your spin and when it's not nearby your spin. And there have been already some precision magnetometry experiments based on that, which have searched for these spin-dependent forces. This is a plot now showing the product of those two coupling constants for the scalar and the dipole coupling on the vertical scale. And then here I have the force range from 10 centimeters down to 30 microns. Or equivalently, on the upper axis, I have the mass of the QCD axion, where the light mass axions here, micro EV up to millielectron volts. So those magnetometry experiments have excluded this light blue area up here at the top. So it was pointed out by Raffelt that if you combine astrophysics with the best experimental limits, you can actually exclude a more substantial part of the parameter space, which is this shaded tan area over here. But if you ask where does the QCD axion live on this plot, it's actually several orders of magnitude below this. So the axion would be expected to be somewhere in this purple band here, where the upper part of that band is due to the bounds from the neutron electric dipole moment. We know theta QCD has to be less than about 10 to the minus 10. There's also a lower edge of the band, though, and that is due to the fact that there is still some CP violation in the standard model that can couple through higher order effects. And so we know theta QCD should be expected to be bigger than about 10 to the minus 16. And so the natural place for the axion to live then would be somewhere in between these two lines. So Ariadne is based on a slightly different technique, also using NMR, where we're going to now imply or use a resonant enhancement to improve the sensitivity. So again, let's take my helium-3 nucleus and put it in a magnetic field. I get an energy splitting between spin up and spin down that's related to the nuclear Larmor precession frequency once again. But now, rather than looking at a static shift in the Larmor frequency when I bring my mass nearby, I'm actually going to oscillate the mass nearby. So I'm going to change this distance between the mass and the spin at that same nuclear Larmor resonance frequency. And when I do that, let's see if this works. So then I will basically have a transverse component of the effective magnetic field, which is going to drive spin precession in here, causing the spin of the helium to precess around the axis of the applied field. And then I can detect that precessing transverse magnetization. And so the win here is due to the fact that I have this resonant enhancement by the effective quality factor, which is going to be the frequency, the Larmor frequency, times the T2, which is the transverse relaxation time in the nucleus. And so this effective Q factor can be quite large. And so the actual experimental geometry looks a little more like that, where we have a helium-3 gas that's in a container, and then we have our unpolarized mass, which is going to drive the spin precession just due to this axion potential that's nearby the helium. So this is shaped like a gear with teeth on it. And so this device basically will spin, and when it spins, let's see if I can get this to work. The teeth of this thing are spinning by, and when they do so, they're basically modulating that effective magnetic field, again, where now the frequency that the teeth are spinning is chosen to match the Larmor precession frequency, and so I resonantly drive the precession of the spin using the spinning tungsten wheel. And so this thing needs to be in an enclosure with superconducting magnetic shielding in order to block regular magnetic field noise from acting on the sample at a level that's higher than the fictitious magnetic field from the axion that you're looking for. And so the fundamental limit is due to the quantum transverse projection noise in the spins, which is of order 10 to the minus 20 tesla per root hertz for cubic centimeter volume, and it goes like 1 over the square root of the volume times the density times the T2.
What's the frequency?
So in our case, we're running with this frequency of about 100 hertz, the frequency of the teeth passing. And so we actually divide the frequency, so the cylinder has 11 segments. I'll show a picture of the actual mass later, but you have 11 segments here in the source mass, so we're actually spinning the wheel at 1/11th of that, so it's about 9 hertz that the wheel is actually spinning. And so with 100 hertz nuclear Larmor precession frequency, our density of 210 to the 21 per cubic centimeter, and the volume of the sample for us is a centimeter by a few millimeters by 150 microns, and a separation distance of order 200 microns. So what we have here in the chamber are three sample chambers. So you're kind of looking down, so there's a spinning wheel in the middle of all three of them. Here's the apparatus that rotates it. So if you look down at the sample chamber from the top, there's about a 50 micron gap between these two surfaces. This is the spinning source mass. And then you have this quartz block, which is coated with a niobium superconducting layer for the magnetic shielding. And the sample chamber is in this pancake-shaped cavity, which is near the surface of the quartz block, behind which we have a squid magnetometer to detect the precessing magnetic field.
What's the scale in the picture?
Yeah, so this is 4 millimeters, this bar. Yeah. Yeah.
Helium-3 because it's cold, and then... Is that correct? And then the other question is getting a laser in there to spin polarize the what intensities and
good question. Yeah, so helium-3 for two reasons. It's cold, it's a gas at a temperature at which we can get superconducting shielding working, and it's a spin 1/2 nucleus, so we wouldn't want any quadrupole shifts from higher order spin nuclei. We actually laser polarized the sample prior to injecting it into the vacuum, into the cryostat. So it's polarized outside, has a long, very long T1 time, and so you can actually transport it in when it's already polarized.
Okay.
It's helium gas you would use?
Helium gas.
Why not liquid?
Well, you could do liquid. You get a little more density, but then there's some nonlinear effects that may show up and make the measurement more difficult. So we're starting off with gas, and eventually we may try to upgrade to liquid, but until we understand the systematics and the way it works, we're starting off with gas.
Your tungsten is, first of all, the naive question is, tungsten paramagnetic? Is your tungsten is somehow spin polarized or spinning?
Not at all. The tungsten is completely unpolarized. There are some residual magnetic impurities, and I'll show some data in a couple of slides that we're going to try to measure the impurities. But no, we want it actually to be completely unpolarized and completely not magnetic. And so this interaction is a mass spin coupling. So the fact that I have the helium spin, there's still an interaction between that helium spin and a completely unpolarized mass. There's another term you might look for where you have two polarized masses, but we're not trying to find that one.
And so the only reason you need the superconducting shield is because the tungsten is a little bit spinny. You wish it wasn't, but
well, magnetic. Not only the tungsten, but the environment itself,
sure.
Right? So we're trying to measure a really, really tiny magnetic field, and any other magnetic field that could be fluctuating, which could drive precession of the spin, would produce a background. And so we need to really keep a quiet environment around. The only way to do that is with a superconducting shielding, due to Johnson noise in regular materials. And I'll say briefly a little more about that. But so with this setup, our projected sensitivity is something like here, where depending on what the T2 that we achieve, whether it's from 1 second up to 1,000 seconds, and I think even 1,000 seconds is fairly conservative for these kind of systems, we can start to then exclude everything above this red band where we can now potentially get into the parameter space for the QCD axion. And then by suitably scaling up the system, it's possible to imagine getting all the way down to this solid blue line once we really understand the limitations of the experiment. The sensitivity due to the squid magnetometer is actually all the way down here at the dotted line. So
what's the squid magnetometer in this
setup? So we have the squid magnetometer, which is basically sitting behind the sample, which is measuring the magnetic field from the helium processing.
And how are you applying that bias field?
You need a pretty uniform field, and you're inside a superconducting volume, so applying the bias field is non-trivial. I have a slide on that in a second. So.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
Is T2 determined by the environment that the helium sits in?
Yeah, so it's determined by things like the collisions with the walls or also the magnetic field gradients. If you have a magnetic field gradient, you have inhomogeneous shifts, so depending on where you're sitting in the volume.
Is there kind of a theoretical limit to how good T2 can be?
Yeah, so.
It's 1,000 cycles for liquid.
Okay.
And 10 to the 4 seconds for gas. So n times T2, I think, remains a constant.
Yeah, it's somewhere around 10 to the 4, yeah.
Yeah, so the reason is this is...
Well, but it depends on the density,
the reason
yeah.
is that there is... what is the probability that the spin flips when you lose polarization, gets defaced when it interacts with other helium atoms in the fluid? There's a cool fact actually about the NMR. I mean, sorry, but it's called motional narrowing. So it turns out that Aquarius time is much longer for fluids than it is for solids. And the reason is this T2, there are two times. There's T1, which is how long does the system stays magnetized for. And there's T2, which is the precession. The precession of Aquarius time.
T1
so how long? T1 is much longer than okay. T2 usually. So if you have, let's say, in a solid, you can have two things. If you have a spin like this and the spin next to its point like this, they will be phased pretty fast, right? Because it depends on the density of the spin times the magnetic field that the neighboring spin sees. In a fluid, the things move around each other, so the magnetic field averages and the gradients go down.
It looks more uniform.
Yeah, it
right?
looks more
yeah.
uniform in fluids. So it turns out that T2 in fluids in general, in gases, it just things move around each other. So if you have, if you are in the from the viewpoint of one spin, things move around you fast. So the gradients average out. So you don't get phased that fast.
But in the gas, but I mean, they average out in the gas also.
Yes, a gas fluid. Yeah, a gas or a liquid.
But you're saying the liquid is better.
No, you get
I'm
better.
Saying,
better.
I'm saying
fluid.
Nice,
the,
sorry.
But,
so it,
yeah.
It depends on the density, right? So,
so the density is bad in this sense. So if you are more dense, you will collide.
So the point is that things move around.
You're right, but the projection noise limit, you actually want the product of n times the T2. So you can trade one over the other, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So is the liquid or the gas better?
They're about the same.
The gas is easier with the systematics anyway.
Sometimes T2 is about the same.
Yes, theoretically, yeah.
Yeah.
Just along these lines, so are you guys going to put some paraffin on the walls?
Well, yeah, so the best material for coating the walls of glass would actually be cesium. It's one of the few things that helium-3 doesn't wet when it bounces into. We don't expect at these levels to be, I think quartz is probably good enough, given that we're dealing with the gas, to get T2s up to 1,000, based on some other work people have done. Actually, there's a work at Berlin where the group at PTB showed T2s that were really, really long. I think it was more than hours, where they had non-coated surfaces. So I think, but much less density. So I think probably we'll be in the case where we're initially not limited by the walls, but eventually, if we need to, we can look at potentially doing cesium coating. Depending how, certainly not for 1 second. But we'll see how it goes. So. Yeah, so in this experiment, there are many challenges in terms of dealing with noise sources and systematics. This is mostly a theory audience, so I'm definitely not going to say too much, except to mention that we're doing work now to kind of understand a few of what we think are kind of the leading candidates for creating problems, one of which has already been mentioned, that we have to really take good care to control the mandated gradients in the environment. We're doing measurements of the vibration of this rotating mass. And then we're also looking at the effects which we need the superconducting shielding to mitigate, in particular magnetic noise due to Johnson noise and other effects from impurities and that sort of thing. And so the magnetic shielding that we need is actually superconducting because we have to avoid that Johnson noise. Regular materials have this thermal motion of their electrons, which causes a fluctuating magnetic spectrum near the materials. Superconductors are immune from that. And so the shielding works on the Meissner effect. If you have a superconducting boundary, you can't have the flux penetrating it. Mathematically, it's convenient to think about that just using the method of images. So I have this superconducting wall where I have a polarized helium-3 nucleus here. It's basically like a dipole. The conditions for this Meissner effect can be analyzed by basically putting an image dipole across the other side of the boundary such that the component of the field that's perpendicular to the surface essentially cancels on the surface at the boundary. And so we can make a uniform, we want the magnetic field to be completely uniform inside the sample volume. It turns out we can do this just by doing a spherical geometry or a spheroidal geometry. So you may remember from Jackson's E&M, if you take a uniformly magnetized sphere, it has a constant magnetic field. Turns out you can deform the sphere into a pancake as long as it's kind of a spheroidal shape and still keep a constant field. The problem now is that we're up against the superconducting boundary, and when you take your sample next to the superconducting boundary, there's basically an image sample of polarized dipoles across the boundary. The magnetic field from that image sample then acts at the location of the original sample and then spoils what was originally the nice constant field inside the volume. And this can cause inhomogeneous broadening or variations in that nuclear Larmor frequency, which creates limitations since we want to drive the whole sample on resonance to take advantage of a large T2. So in order to mitigate that, our strategy is to use a pattern coil inside of our niobium-coated quartz block where we can run a compensation current. So we can apply a current through this loop, which then, along with its image and so forth, creates a total field that combines with that field from the spheroid to kind of fill in the gaps of the gradient. And so here's a plot of the magnetic field along the central section of the sample along this axis, where we have a variation without that compensation of order, a microtesla field over the volume, over that volume. With this compensation coil, we can flatten that field to about a factor of part in 100. And so that gives me now the ability to access these T2s again that are of order hundreds of seconds. It was asked also, how do we control the magnetic field, the background DC value apart from the gradient? I also have to control the magnitude of the field. to ensure the resonance between the spinning disk and the Larmor frequency. And so up against a boundary, we cannot use regular Helmholtz fields since we can't put a Helmholtz coil up against a superimposing boundary. So what we do here is a trick we call decoils. We split the Helmholtz coil in half, essentially. And so if I have a half-circular current path where one of the paths is along the superarcing boundary, then there's basically an image path on the other side, and the current goes opposite directions along the wall. And so by making a D-shaped coil next to the wall, I can basically get a field that's equivalent to as if there's a complete loop where I'm up right up against the wall of the superconducting boundary. And so if I put two of these in above and below the sample, I can use this to create an effectively a Helmholtz field at the center and get good enough field uniformity across the sample. So the squid magnetometers for the experiment have already been fabricated. This is by our Korean collaborators, where we've measured sensitivities of the squids on our quartz substrate of a few femtotesla per hertz. This is more than sufficient for getting the sensitivity we need for the signal from the processing helium. We're working on developing the superconducting shielding for the sample containers. So also worked on from another group of collaborators at Korea. We've deposited niobium films to start with some quartz tube geometries where we have order micron thick niobium film. We're measuring the superconducting transition temperature, and we're working on optimizing that and also the adhesion of the film onto the quartz substrates. So we're optimistic that we should have the superconducting shielding figured out in the next few months. Hopefully the tungsten mass has already been built. We have a first prototype of the mass. This is the tungsten rotor has these teeth here that spin. So we've measured the magnetic impurities in this after the machining of the tungsten to make sure there's no leftover magnetic impurities from post-machining. So we did this first with a commercial squid magnetometer looking at the fragments from the machining, and we have shown that the magnetic impurities are below about half a part per million. So our target for given our expected shielding factor was about 1 ppm, so we're on target to realize the ultimate sensitivity. So far, we've also had a group that we've recently started collaborating with at Berlin look at it in their squid magnetometer and PTB. And so after degaussing the wheel, they're measuring residual field of a couple picotesla near the surface, which is at the level roughly of the Johnson noise, which is agreeing with what we expect and is on target for the level of assuming we have realized the level of shielding we did in the niobium film. This level of magnetization should not stop us from getting the sensitivity that we need. We've also tested the stability of our rotation apparatus, where we basically have, if we have these high T2 times, we need to keep a very constant rotational speed. And so we have a feedback and an optical encoder to do that. And we've measured speed controls that are a level of part in 10,000, which are good enough for that level of sensitivity. So we're excited to hopefully start building the real experimental apparatus based on what we're learning about these different fabrications, hopefully by this summer. And in the last couple minutes, I just wanted to mention one other idea for related to using AMO methods for looking for ultralight scalar dark matter. So we already heard, yeah.
Sorry, just one basic question that I'm missing. Is the main motivation to go cold to use superconducting shielding, and that's why you wouldn't want to do this with like a room temperature vapor cell like that?
Yes.
That's not viable.
Yes. The superconducting shielding is what's driving going to cold. Yeah.
Because you need to shield anything residual from that tungsten.
Not only from the tungsten, but from everything around the environment. Yeah. From metal nearby, or whatever.
Yeah, but the
tungsten's closest, probably. Yeah, sure. Right, and it's varying at the frequency of interest.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, but you could use regular shielding. Well, anyway, yeah. But that's right. I mean, so you also are worried about just environmental noise in addition to the
and that
the noise
forces the or that kind of dictates the pickup using a squid because you have to be cold and
Well, yeah, the, since you're already cold, the squid is kind of a natural choice. Yeah. It's not, I wouldn't say, maybe not essential. There might be some way, another way to do that. Because you're not using the full sensitivity of the squid. Okay, so, right, so then as a last thought, so we've also thought about some ideas, although we're not doing in the experiment at the moment, to look for ultralight scalar dark matter. So it was mentioned yesterday at the discussion, you could have dark matter as light as the size of dwarf galaxies, or 10 minus 22 EV. And in these, in this regime, you can think about the dark matter field like a coherent field rather than a particle, where you have some oscillation amplitude, where that amplitude is related to one over, related to the, sorry, the square root of the dark matter density, rho of dark matter, over the mass of the dark matter particle. And so there are many techniques now for proposed for detecting these oscillations, so including things like clocks. Yesterday we heard about the bar detectors, torsion balances, or atom interferometers is another approach. So we had a recent idea to look for an effect using atom interferometers. And so in particular, an atom interferometer basically involves taking an atomic wave packet and splitting it in a couple different trajectories, and then looking at the difference in the phase acquired by the atom as it's going along the trajectories. And then when you recombine the two atoms, you can measure out a signal. One thing you can measure with this is an acceleration. So the phase, you accumulate in the difference between these interferometer arms goes like the gravitational acceleration g times the effective k vector of the laser times the time squared, with the time between these laser pulses and these setups. And so in particular, if the dark matter field is causing the masses of fundamental particles to vary, then in particular, the mass of the Earth can vary, and the mass of the atom can vary. And so as the atom is undertaking some trajectory in the system, it's seeing a time difference, a time variation in that gravitational acceleration towards the Earth. And it's also seeing a difference because when the atom is hit with, say, this laser pulse, its mass may be different than when it's hit with this laser pulse because its mass is oscillating with time. And so the fact that the mass of the atom is oscillating and the mass of the Earth is oscillating means that G is oscillating and this phase shift is essentially getting modulated. And so it's possible with these kind of interferometers then to look for these ultralight dark matter at kind of the below Hertz kind of timescales, where this is the balance from the equivalence principle in the shaded yellow area. And if you had a relatively long baseline setup, you could get a few orders of magnitude improvement at the short distance end of that.
So can you explain again, why do the two, you have a beam, you have two beams, right?
Yeah.
Well, why is the phase difference? Why is it not quite so the same
phase? Yeah, so you can think about this as a single atom, and you split its wave packet along two different paths. So one part of the atomic wave packet goes one way, and the other part goes the other. And depending on what each one feels, you know, it's in a different location in whatever background fields it's in, right? And so then when you recombine this, you pick up a phase due to the interaction with the laser pulses, because the different parts of the wave packets are in different spatial positions when they interact. Yeah. Okay. So with that, let me just conclude. So I talked about a few different AMO-based methods that are looking for high-energy physics type effects at the sensitivity frontier. We have these zeptonewton sensitivity levitated particles, which we're hoping to apply for gravitational tests. We're hoping this new Ariadne experiment can eventually close this gap in the current searches for the QCD axion at scales between, say, 10 milliEV down to 0.1 milliEV. And it's really complementary to other kind of experiments, for example, the cavity experiments, since we're looking for the coupling of nucleons. Another feature of it is that we don't need to scan any mass in this experiment. For us, the mass is just set in the interaction range due to the axion potential. And so we can basically scan all the masses at the same time, and it makes no assumptions about the local dark matter density on Earth. And then I talked about our recent thoughts on new ideas for using atom interferometers. And so with that, let me just acknowledge some of the people doing the work and our funding agents, and thanks for your attention.
All right, we've asked you lots of questions. Are there any more questions for you? If not, I think the only thing we have going on today is people gathering for lunch at 12:15 by the main entrance, and the Cold Dark Matter Small Scale Structure Program has something going on. So, thank you again.